loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has made a final plea to the Trump administration to veto a measure from Congress aimed at discouraging class action lawsuits against financial companies. Meanwhile, the big banks are set for another big win with the expected appointment of Jerome Powell to lead the Federal Reserve. Next, suspended Catalan President Puigdemont has denied that he is seeking asylum in Belgium and has vowed to contest the upcoming regional election imposed by the Spanish central government. Then, Qatar's former foreign minister has come forward with surprisingly candid comments about the war in Syria, detailing the U.S., Saudi, Qatari efforts to overthrow the Syrian government and their connections to Al-Qaeda. And finally, Saudi officials have announced that they will be vastly expanding their nuclear energy program and possibly acquiring nuclear weapons. But first, we turn to the banks and the protection of the banks. The head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has made a final plea to the Trump administration to veto a measure from Congress aimed at discouraging class action lawsuits against financial companies. Meanwhile, the big banks are set for another big win with the expected appointment of Jerome Powell to lead the Federal Reserve. We are joined from San Francisco by financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So talk about what's going on, the plea from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to Trump to veto this measure. What is it?
So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we'll call it CFPB for short, is an entity that was created, a regulatory entity that was created under the Obama administration after the 2008 fallout when rampant fraud destabilized the U.S. and many other economies as well. And what recently happened was that a rule that the CFPB was going to enforce and was going to become active on the 2019 was essentially overruled and removed by the current Congress. And that rule would allow consumers to engage in class action lawsuits with banks more easily. Currently, whenever you sign up for a bank account, almost without exception, you, as part of the terms and conditions, agree to an arbitration clause, which basically says you waive the right to go to court if you have a problem with the bank, if there's some kind of issue. Instead, you go to an arbitration panel, which does not have a jury of 12, does not follow normal court proceedings, and streamlines the process. And this makes it much harder for consumers to engage in class action lawsuits. So a simple example is if you think of the more than 3 million accounts that were opened by Wells Fargo, those consumers, those 3 million people that were hurt, could band together and have a huge class action lawsuit. But if they were prohibited from having class action lawsuits under these sorts of legislation, then they'd have to individually go to arbitration, which is much more time consuming and much more unlikely that all these customers would take the time to go in, go before an arbitration panel, request an arbitration panel, et cetera, as opposed to participating in a class action lawsuit, which allows a much more easy to engage in and much more streamlined process for the customers. So it's a huge win for the banks, in short, and a real big blow against American consumers.
Daniel, since we're a little pressed for time, I'd like to jump over to the issue of the new Fed chairman. The Washington Post ran an article today saying that that the person being chosen, Jerome Powell, is a safe choice. And that was the quote from the Post, that the White House is saying it's a safe choice. And the Post went on to say that Vice President Pence favored John B. Taylor, who is a Stanford economist. He's been an outspoken critic of the Fed. If Powell is the safe choice, why not just reappoint Yellen? What kind of policy is Donald Trump trying to make here? What are we supposed to take from this?
I think this is kind of a bow to sort of the Republican establishment. So he's been a Fed governor since 2012. He's a Republican and he has deep roots in the party's establishment in the financial services industry. So he's a solid Republican choice. He's also more or less supported Yellen's approach to monetary policy and financial regulation. And it's unlikely he would create or attempt to create any sharp changes from the Fed's current choice. So that's kind of what they mean by the safe choice, in terms of he's going to keep the ship steering in a more or less straight direction. And as you can see, the current administration has been anything but kind of safe or consistent. And I think this is kind of a tip of the hat in their direction. You know, like almost all Fed chairmen, you know, he comes from financial services industry, from brokerage firms and very, you know, wealthy investment firms, and really, you know, understands and protects their interests, just like previous ones have in the past. So he's not really a radical departure from how the Fed has been run traditionally.
Brian, interestingly enough, Politico says that he would be the first Fed governor in more than 40 years to not have a degree in economics. And Politico essentially is saying the same thing that Daniel's telling us, that he's a moderate, he's an establishment Republican, he's not one to make waves. And also, interestingly, you know, he has to be confirmed by the United States Senate. The only opposition to his potential appointment so far has come from Republicans, from conservatives. And it's specifically Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, the only African-American Republican in the Senate, and Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, both conservative Republicans, both part of that conservative wave of the last few cycles. They're the only ones who have expressed any opposition. And it's simply because he's too moderate. One last point. He has voted for every Fed policy that that Yellen has endorsed and voted for. So it looks like this is going to be more of the same. This is not a boat rocker. This is somebody very moderate. I mean, Donald Trump could have really put a conservative stamp on the Fed with a different appointment, and he chose not to do that.
Well, and also Donald Trump, perhaps recognizing that while he needs voters to vote for him, in between elections, the base really is, in many ways, Wall Street. Because if Wall Street really turns against you big time and fundamentally, you're done. You're done politically in the United States. Daniel, let's talk about what the Federal Reserve is. I think there's a mystique about it. It's appointed by the president. It's an instrument of the U.S. government, but it considers itself an independent central bank because its monetary policy decisions do not have to be approved by the president or anyone else in the executive or legislative branches of government. And it doesn't receive funding appropriated by Congress. So just talk about the Federal Reserve, what its real function is in modern day late stage capitalism, so to speak. I mean, it was born in 1913. Its role and its powers have expanded, but just help the audience really sort of understand it, demystify this for us.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one of the couple of things you mentioned, Brian, is that they're supposedly independent and not connected to kind of congressional sort of oversight and control. And I think that's really important to understand, because what that means is undemocratic. They're not controlled or connected to individuals who are elected and could be unelected if they don't, you know, perform what the population wants them to. So they're a collection of, you know, private bankers, very wealthy billionaires, and really their job is to create stability and economic opportunity for the financial services industry and the economy as a whole. So their job is to create stability, because if there's one thing wealthy investors and wealthy business people don't like, is uncertainty and instability. And their job is to try to banish that as much as possible. So they do this through a number of economic levers that basically manipulate monetary policy in different directions to produce economic growth or to cool down an overheated economy. But especially in the last 20 years, and especially since the 2008 crisis, they've more and more gone in a direction where their policy is really to benefit the banking industry, which are deeply impacted by their policies because they control interest rates and monetary supply. So really their job, especially lately, has been less about directing the overall economy and benefiting the financial services industry, the big banks.
So are we going to see any kind of real changes? It seems that the Fed acts very collaboratively and deliberately. Do you see any real policy changes coming out of this appointment?
No, because he's, you know, kind of detached from the Trump administration.
Right.
He doesn't have to play ball with the Trump administration. He doesn't have to go along with this kind of wild populist politics. So I think we'll see more of what Yellen did. I don't think we'll see anything radical. I think this is a big win for establishment Republicans who just kind of want this Trump thing to be over and to blow away. And I don't see any real significant changes. You know, back in Obama's day, all the Republicans talked about, we would hold the banks accountable. We would stick it to them. We wouldn't do what these Democrats did. And really, this is just kind of more of the same. Now that they're in charge, now that they have real power, they're just kind of voting for business as usual.
I want to go back to the issue of democracy, if we could, Daniel, because I can remember very vividly the Federal Reserve in 1978 and 79 concerned about raging inflation at that time, which was very bad for the banks because it meant as the currency devalued, if you borrowed $1,000 from the bank, and the value of $1,000 changed and diminished greatly, that meant that you could pay the interest back on the banks to the banks on, you know, in a way that would allow you to keep more of your own money. In other words, less goes to them. So the banks wanted to suppress inflation. The Federal Reserve just ended or closed down credit sources. I mean, they had that capacity, and it sent the country into a profoundly deep recession. From 1979 to 82, inflation was suppressed, but so was employment. And that also began the era where wages were started to be driven down, and they've never, ever recovered. Again, you have after the 2008 crisis, the Federal Reserve started the policy of quantitative easing, which basically meant that the Federal Reserve gave the banks $4 trillion. It didn't require the banks to do anything with that money. So the banks have plowed that money into the stock market, that creating this huge surge in stock prices, not real jobs, not, you know, things that actually benefited people. It benefited investors. In our last 2.5 minutes, talk about that feature. The U.S. Constitution doesn't have a Federal Reserve as another branch of government.
No, it doesn't. And this is a little bit like the Supreme Court in terms of there are people that are appointed and then don't have any kind of electoral process by which they might be removed. I think that, you know, when you talk about what happened in the late 70s and early 80s, the banks didn't like inflation, right? It was costing them a lot of money, as you said. And to reduce the inflation rates, you had to reduce employment rates, and you had to cool down the economy, which is a way of saying people losing their jobs and getting pushed out. And that, of course, really hurt working people, but it really helped the banks in the long run, and it, quotes, cooled down the economy. And it was done through this mechanism that has to be profoundly undemocratic, because if it was democratic, if people were really allowed to set the monetary policy and, you know, vote out easily Fed chairman, then you wouldn't see them doing this. You would see the banks being hurt by it rather than protected by it. So, you know, just like the Supreme Court, where you're appointed for life and you're really not accountable to anyone, it's a similar type of organization. I think a lot of the mystique and confusion around it is just because they want your average American not to understand it, because it so profoundly impacts them. And if they really understood how undemocratic it is and how much it hurts them, they would be furious.
I think Daniel's exactly right. What we have here is somebody who is tailor-made to please the big banks and the Republican establishment. Jerome Powell is 64 years old. He went to Princeton University, got a law degree from Georgetown University, went to Wall Street, worked for Nick Brady. Brady was briefly a senator. He became Treasury Secretary. Powell became Undersecretary for Finance, back to Solomon Smith Barney. When it collapsed, he was the one that convinced Warren Buffett to become chairman of the board in order to save the company. So this is exactly the kind of guy that the Republican establishment is looking for. And at Smith Barney, he got rich. His latest financial disclosure form says he's worth at least $55 million. So he doesn't need the money. He doesn't have to go back. And as it turns out, economics degree or no economics degree, he likes working on the Fed.
It's a good job.
It's a good job if you can get it.
You got $55 million in the bank. You're cool. All right, we're out of time. That was Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Suspended Catalan President Puigdemont has denied that he's seeking asylum in Belgium and has vowed to contest the upcoming regional election imposed by the Spanish central government. We're joined from London by Matt Quartrup. He is a professor of political science at Coventry University and is described by the BBC as the world's leading authority on referendums. And we're joined from London by Steve Keen. He's the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at www.patreon.com/prof Steve Keen. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
This story seems to change every day. Puigdemont fled to Belgium. He didn't flee to Belgium. He went to Belgium. He's not there permanently. He's being offered asylum. He's not being offered asylum, et cetera, et cetera. What are we looking at here? What's happening? Steve, why don't you start?
Well, I think there's a long historical background to how Spain is treating this, and I think there's no doubt that the Spanish government's overreacted to everything and is effectively trying to crush dissent rather than saying, okay, we have regional issues here, let's see how we can handle them, which is the way the British have handled both attempts for succession by the Scots and to some extent the Irish. So it's something in the national character of Spain that these things become more extreme. But my basic argument has always been what's causing the problem isn't really Spain versus Catalonia. It's the impact of the European Union and in particular the euro on the policies that governments like Spain are able to enact. It pushes them to policies that actually cause poverty. And as a result of that, the regions that end up revolting most against that are the ones that used to be fairly wealthy. So we're seeing independence movements, not just in Catalonia, but also in the northern parts of Italy, which are also quite wealthy, and are blaming Rome. And I think really the problems, again, all originate in Brussels.
Matt, because you have a specialty in referendum, I want to ask you about the vote itself, the decision, the mood, and what the people really think and whether what they really think is reflected through a referendum. We had the Brexit referendum that took everybody by surprise. Those who initiated the referendum thought it would validate and give a stronger mandate to remain in the EU. Just the opposite happened. And that set off a chain of events that no one actually fully predicted or even knows now what comes next. Talk about the referendum in the case of Catalonia.
Yeah, just on the Brexit one, 4 months before the referendum, I predicted the exact outcome of that in an academic article. So everybody but me was wrong, but I'm just bragging there, of course.
you stand alone.
I stand alone, and I'm proud of that. And a lot of people rebuke me for that, but he who has the last laugh. I think on the referendum, there's the economic argument that was said before. The Catalans actually had a referendum way back in 2006 on enhanced powers for the region, which they voted for. And then that was invalidated by the Constitutional Court of Spain. And then the whole thing sort of kicked off. So in a way, politically, it also started in a referendum sometimes back. The referendum itself, I think it's difficult to call it a fair referendum. One can say, of course, that the Spanish government overreacted, which they probably did by sending in the police, which I think helped the sympathy vote for the Catalans. But the referendum itself was on a relatively low turnout. Consistently, we've seen in Catalonia, as indeed in Scotland, that a majority is against independence. It's very difficult to find examples of regions where there is a strong support for independence. We've seen back in the day in Canada, in Quebec, it was also two referendums and there was no majority for secession. So the referendum itself in Spain, even if they say it was 90%, it was 90% on a very low turnout. And I think the sensible thing, and I'm not quite sure one can talk about national character and Spaniards being sort of more hot-headed than others, but I think the best way forward would be to look at changing the constitution, which the PSOE, the Socialist Party of Spain, have suggested, and the Spanish government in Madrid has now recognized, because the only way forward with the referendum, the way the referendum would work best, is when there is an elite consensus, and then that consensus is submitted to the voters, which was the way it was in Northern Ireland, and in Scotland, indeed. So I think the referendum itself is not indicative of the will of the people in Catalonia. Whereas in the case of Brexit, I think what the government was surprised to see was that the economic arguments, you know, the fact that the IMF and Goldman Sachs and all the rest of them argue that it's going to be economic ruin if you don't vote for stay in the European Union, that was trumped by nationalist argument and a very powerful argument, take back control. So the political argument was way stronger than the politicians realized. And so I think in Brexit, it was probably the will of the people. There was also a considerably higher turnout there, as indeed there was in Scotland. So I don't think in this case, I mean, I was in Spain during the time, or Catalonia during the time, we should say, perhaps. And the appetite for independence was relatively minimal. You know, if you talk to the usual taxi drivers and the bartenders and so on, they weren't sort of, you didn't get the feeling of revolution in the air. And that's probably the problem that Carlos Puigdemont has at the moment.
Steve, can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I wasn't saying so much as hot-headed Spanish. I was saying, you go back to the Spanish Civil War, and what happened to the political leadership after the Spanish Civil War was not the same thing that happened to a very similar leadership in Italy and Germany. So there's more of, I think, a history of a fairly forceful emphasis of national will within Spain. We're seeing that acted out right now. And I agree, the referendum had a large turnout in one sense, and almost half the population voted, almost all of them voted for independence. Well, it was about 45% turnout and 90% in favour. But it was clearly a case, those who didn't want to vote for it at all boycotted the vote. So you'd have to say that the probable outcome was similar at the regional level to the Scottish referendum. And personally, again, as watching the Scottish referendum, one thing was never considered, never even discussed in any of the documents of pro-independence movement, was what currency we're going to have after we do this. And in fact, the Scots were talking about joining the European Union, and I think also the Catalonians wanted to stay within the European Union and the Eurozone. I think it'd be a catastrophically bad decision. But at least one thing it would do if they did that, they then find out the real enemy wasn't Madrid, but it was Brussels.
Yeah. What happens next? I mean, as John Kiriakou said when we started this show, every day we get a different message. The Catalan president, Puigdemont, is seeking asylum, then he's not seeking asylum. He's moved to Belgium. He's just visiting. He's consulting. The Spanish government is moving very, very forcefully to not only, they've dissolved the Catalan parliament, they've taken over the functions of the state, and they're calling new elections. Are we seeing this kind of come to an end as a consequence of, A, there's not an appetite for real revolution, and B, the Spanish government's forceful intervention? Or will this forceful intervention, will this sort of the lash of the Spanish government breed another kind of resistance?
Well, I think if I may just briefly on that, it's sort of more a Spanish politics point. I think it's important to distinguish the Spanish government from or to talk about different wings within the Spanish government. Of course, Partido Popular is a broad movement or party, and Theas Santa Maria, the deputy prime minister who's now in charge of Catalonia, is more of a pragmatic technocrat, firefighting type of politician who's not very ideological. She's not right wing. She comes from a younger generation than the prime minister, and she's quite a bit of a softy in this matter, who's trying to solve it, if not amicably, then at least in a sort of in a downplayed and not too forceful a manner. So she's aware of the political implications of going too forcefully. The problem is that the chief prosecutor in Spain is a hardliner who is very much of the letter of the law, if it suits him, very much a centralist, and the Minister of the Interior, who also takes the same position. So there is a battle within Partido Popular, and it's indicative that I think Theas Santa Maria is now in charge of Catalonia, because she's more, if you like, of an accommodating sort of politician who would be interested in a more compromise. And I think it's that is indicative of the Spanish approach. So, but she's hampered by, or her efforts are not being helped by the fact that the prosecutor can do as he likes, and his office is quite independent of the government. So the Spanish government is trying to contain their hardliners, but the appointment of the deputy prime minister to run Catalonia is a sign they want to de-escalate, and also the fact they want to change or talk about changing the constitution, which the leading opposition party has suggested, is also a sign they want to do that. And I think on Puigdemont, I think he's a desperate man who is probably not thinking too many steps ahead. He wouldn't be a great chess player, I don't think.
That was exactly my next question, is what do we make of Puigdemont and his recent actions? Is this what a leader does? Has he taken himself out of a leadership role, perhaps inadvertently, by dashing off to Brussels, even if it's temporary? Are Catalonians in the street still looking to Puigdemont for leadership, or no? Are they moving on? Steve?
I honestly don't know. I think I can't help thinking, by the way, the Monty Python. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. We're getting it again with this one. And there's no real know of which way they're going to go on it. It's a very, very good summary of the struggle inside the ruling party. And it just depends who wins that battle. If the prosecutor would have decided to arrest Puigdemont, which is quite feasible, it could have turned into a political, you know, not a dead one, but a political martyr in that sense, which could have revived quite a bit of serious and potentially violent protest in Catalonia. So that's one of the worries. I certainly hope it does defuse, but there's no guarantee that defusing is going to be the outcome.
I think they just to echo that, actually, and second that, I think it is true that if Puigdemont had been there and if he had been arrested and if he sort of, you know, faced the music, if you like, that could have caused a problem. I think the Spanish government, when I spoke to a colleague in Spain this morning, he says this is the best thing that's happened to the Spanish constitution for a long time, that he goes away. It's not because he's clever, but it's just, you know, it's fortuitous, as it were, that he ran away. What is interesting, though, on the street, and I can't speak as an expert on Spanish politics, but I suppose as a professor of European politics, I ought to know a little bit about it. What is interesting about the polls, insofar as we have polls for the next election, is that most people who would vote, who are independentistas, if you like, would probably vote for the Republican Party, the more radical option. And they are likely to get a very good election, the people who are the hardliner, who want independence basically yesterday, whereas Puigdemont's party is a centre-right party. It's not quite like the Scottish National Party, which is broadly on the left. And a lot of people who are socially conservative would not vote for a party that is sort of more anarchistic, like the Republicans. So it is very likely that Puigdemont, he's too softly softliner for the people who want independence now. And of course, he is anathema to everybody who is a unionist. So the likelihood of him being reelected is small, because it has sort of polarized not only public opinion in Catalonia, but also among the voters for the next general election in the region. And I suppose that's the reason why he didn't call elections, was that he was realizing that his party would be the likely loser of an election. The Madrid government is aware that the parties that are more extreme are more likely to win that election, and they can be then isolated because they are seen as being very much on the left.
All right, I think we're gonna leave it right there. Steve Keen, we'll let you have the last 15 seconds, if you would.
Well, I'm just thinking about the only other time something of the scale has happened. It was back in Australia in 1975, when the then Whitlam government was sacked by a conservative-leaning governor they themselves had installed. And the outcome of that was, in fact, the Labor Party lost the next election and the Conservatives took over in a landslide. I don't think it's going to be the Radicals take over in a landslide this way back, but it certainly won't have the consequences, I think, that either the Madrid or Barcelona expected.
Matt Quartrup at Coventry University in the UK and Steve Keen in London, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it very much and look forward to having you both back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Qatar's former foreign minister has come forward with a surprisingly candid comment or comments about the war in Syria, detailing the U.S. Saudi Qatari efforts to overthrow the Syrian government, and even admitting that there may have been, quote, interaction, close quote, with Al-Qaeda. We are joined from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Oh, good to be with you.
Thank you so much. Well, Qatar, Saudi, U.S. supporting Al-Qaeda, maybe an admission here, but already perhaps the worst-kept secret in the world. Talk about it, if you would.
Well, indeed, sir. I mean, I think for a very long time, anybody who has followed the Syrian war with any degree of attention will have been aware that most of the people who were fighting the Syrian government and were seeking to overthrow the Syrian government were various Wahhabi jihadi insurgent groups. The dominant ones amongst them were ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and that the most powerful anti-Syrian government rebel group in the west of Syria, the one that directly threatened the Syrian government in its two major cities of Aleppo and Damascus, was Al-Qaeda, acting through its various names in Syria, of which al-Nusra is the most famous, and that throughout that time it had the support of those governments around the world which wanted to overthrow the Syrian government, specifically Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and ultimately the United States. So we have this extraordinary situation that the United States, which is fighting Al-Qaeda around the world, which has launched the war on terror against it, which has operates the prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, which has done all sorts of things, at the same time was in alliance with Al-Qaeda in Syria, fighting the Syrian government.
It's really remarkable when one thinks about it. Alexander, I was the one of the founders of an organization called ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. We were founded 3 days after September 11th. We lived in New York City, not far from the World Trade Center. We had friends inside the World Trade Center. We said the George W. Bush administration would pretextually take advantage of Al-Qaeda's attack, or an attack they said was carried out by Al-Qaeda, to carry out a larger war, the war on terror, which became simply just a banner for U.S. intervention everywhere, including against governments like the Iraqi government, which was clearly hostile to and an opponent of Al-Qaeda. But nonetheless, here we had, for the last 15, 16 years, the U.S. foreign policy of extreme interventionism based on the war on terror and the fight against Al-Qaeda. And now we hear from a notable principal U.S. ally that Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the United States were sending money and weapons to Syria, and they were ending up in the hands of Al-Qaeda, or were directed to end up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. And yet the American people are still told, please keep forking over your tax dollars for the military budget because we have to keep up this war on terror. I mean, it's a stunning level of hypocrisy.
Stunning level of hypocrisy, and I'm sure I'm right in saying, Brian, that you feel absolutely no pleasure to be completely vindicated in all the criticisms that you and your group in New York in 2001 after 9/11 made, because they have all come true, and they've all come true in the most terrible and appalling way. Because, of course, what actually happened, and it was exactly as you said, is that this attack or this terrorist attack on New York and on the United States was used as a pretext to justify various aggressive regime change wars in the Middle East, because these wars were never clearly announced for what they were. They always relied to a very high degree on proxies. The result is that the United States found itself, in order to prosecute those wars, entering into all sorts of strange alliances with all sorts of people. And amongst those alliances, in place after place, it ended up in de facto alliance with Al-Qaeda. I think many people in the United States, if they knew about what had happened and what their government has done in the Middle East, would feel deeply betrayed. But of course, exactly as you say, the truth is being kept from them.
I want to ask you, Alexander, about how these revelations are coming out and why they're coming out, right now. Last week, the Intercept carried an article by Murtaza Hussein. The headline was, NSA document says Saudi prince directly ordered coordinated attacks by Syrian rebels on Damascus. I want to read a couple sentences to you and then talk about what they signify, what these revelations signify, but also why they're happening right now. Here we go. Here's from The Intercept last week, October 24th. A loosely knit collection of Syrian rebel fighters set up positions on March 18, 2013, and fired several barrages of rockets at targets in the heart of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad's capital. The attack was a brazen show of force by rebels under the banner of the Free Syrian Army, targeting the presidential palace, Damascus International Airport, and a government security compound. It sent a chilling message to the regime about its increasingly shaky hold on the country 2 years after an uprising against its rule began. Behind the attacks, the influence of a foreign power loomed. According to a top-secret National Security Agency document provided by whistleblower Edward Snowden, the March 2013 rocket attacks were directly ordered by a member of the Saudi royal family, a Prince Salman bin Sultan, to help mark the second anniversary of the Syrian revolution. Salman had provided 120 tons of explosives and other weaponry to opposition forces, giving them instructions to, quote, light up Damascus, close quote, and flatten, quote, the airport, the document produced by a U.S. government surveillance on Syrian opposition faction shows. Okay, that's a pretty remarkable admission. And this document comes from Edward Snowden, whistleblower. But Qatar itself, its foreign minister is now coming out and making some of these same reports. Does it have to do with the sort of the falling out within the Gulf countries between Qatar, between Saudi Arabia? And what's that all about?
Yes, it does. I mean, the fact is that Qatar and Saudi Arabia have been vigorous allies and also deadly rivals in the Middle East for a long time. Both of them have Wahhabi ideology as the ideology of their state systems, but their two royal families have never really got on with each other. And Saudi Arabia has always been suspicious of the fact that Qatar has tended to pursue an independent line. There's also been a certain difference in emphasis, with Saudi Arabia rather more inclined to support the more radical groups like Al-Qaeda, and Qatar perhaps more drawn to slightly more moderate groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. But we are always talking about Islamic jihadi groups that have been fighting in all sorts of places, Libya, Syria, to overthrow those governments. Now, what has happened over the last few months is that the tensions, which have always existed within the Qatari-Saudi relationship, have exploded into a major public row. The Saudis are now making concerted efforts to force Qatar to come to heel. The Qataris are resisting. The Qataris, in turn, have turned to other friends to help them in this confrontation with Saudi Arabia. So they've moved somewhat closer to countries like Russia and Iran. Russia and Iran are, of course, the major supporters in the Middle East of the Syrian government. And clearly, the Qataris, under an awful lot of pressure, are saying some of these things that they're now saying, probably as a way to distance themselves from what they have done in the past and to improve their relations with their new allies.
I mean, Qatar, when you look at the map, it's a very, very, very tiny little island. The hereditary monarchy, the Al Thani family, has ruled the place since the beginning of the 19th century. I believe it's the 19th century. That means 200 years of blood monarchy, family rule. It's a high income economy. It's got perhaps the world's third largest natural gas reserves and oil reserves. So it's kind of like a big, it's a big sort of oil well with a flag on it. And the royal family has been there ruling the roost for 200 years. Why be so aggressive in its foreign policy? What's driving Qatar? And again, let's just start with that. Like, why are they trying to play with the big boys in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, which is such a much bigger country?
Well, I think that comes back to the big question that we discussed just now, which is that the Qataris, to some extent, are very close ideologically to the Saudis. And precisely for that reason, they want to distance themselves from the Saudis. The Saudis are very much the big boys on the block. Saudi Arabia is a much far and away the biggest country in the Gulf. And it tends to think of the other Gulf states as essentially its vassals. And inevitably, whenever you have a kind of vassal relationship, the vassals sometimes resent the intended overlord. So you will always have those tensions. The other thing is, and you've pointed out the enormous wealth that Qatar gets from its oil and gas, and the fact that at the same time it is a very small country. When a small country becomes as rich as Qatar has become, the temptation to play a big game is always very strong. And I think in Qatar's case, they have wildly overplayed their hand. They have tried to make themselves, through their money, a major power and influence in the Middle East. And they're now finding that that is an extremely dangerous thing to do, and that they're not really in a position to play that kind of game alongside giant powers like Saudi Arabia, Iran, not to mention the United States and Russia.
On October 25th, the United States Department of Treasury and all of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, the GCC, imposed sanctions on 8 individuals and 1 business suspected of financing, facilitating, and arming al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Now we're talking about Yemen, an Islamic state in Yemen. These sanctions are first imposed by the U.S.-Saudi Arabia-chaired Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, TFTC, following Donald Trump's visit. And it seems to me, Alexander, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that this is really directed against Qatar and could have a very, very big impact since it is a very small place.
It could indeed. And that is, I think you're exactly right, because, of course, one of the strange things was that Qatar, as I said, had this very strange relationship with Saudi Arabia, being both an ally and a rival. And as part of that alliance, if you will, it was also part of the anti-Yemen coalition that was cobbled together by Saudi Arabia. And it cooperated and worked with Saudi Arabia to fight the Houthi groups, the more Shia, or, well, they're not necessarily Shia, but the more independent groups in Yemen that have been resisting Saudi domination of Yemen. So now we have Saudi Arabia, which is manipulating these anti-terrorist organizations that have been set up with the support of the United States, to direct them at its enemy and rival, its new enemy and rival, which is Qatar. And of course, the extraordinary hypocrisy of this, again, is on display. You read to me a piece from The Intercept about the Saudi prince ordering all these attacks on Damascus, and it's the same people who are now talking about terrorism in Yemen and who are sanctioning people.
Indeed. We're out of time. We've been joined from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we'll be right back, so stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Brian Becker.
Saudi officials have announced that they will be vastly expanding their nuclear program as part of the kingdom's ongoing effort to overhaul its economy. We'll take a look at the U.S. government's double standard when it comes to nuclear energy and nuclear weapons in the Middle East. We are joined from Arlington, Virginia by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
Kevin, what should we take from this? You know, the Saudis, this is like the worst kept secret in the world, that the Saudis have long, long sought a nuclear energy capability at the very least. They just have never talked about it. The BBC has had a couple of stories over the years, but most people don't know anything about a Saudi nuclear program. What can you tell us?
Yeah, there's an amazing admission by Mohammed El-Baradei, the Egyptian diplomat who headed the International Atomic Energy Agency for many years. During the critical period when the 2003 Iraq war began, supposedly because Iraq had nuclear weapons capability that he said was not the case. And also with Iran, he played a big role. And he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize because of his efforts to tell the truth about what was happening in Iraq and Iran, that there were not nuclear weapons programs. And so he said late in his tenure, he already had the Nobel Peace Prize, that the only reason that Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries, and remember, he's Egyptian, wanted nuclear power was so that it would give them the option of developing nuclear weapons someday if they chose to go that route. And what was so amazing about him saying that, given his previous work trying to prevent war in Iraq and Iran, was that his mission as director of the IAEA was to promote nuclear power. It's a fatal flaw of the IAEA's mission to supposedly keep a lid on nuclear weapons proliferation, stop that, while at the same time promoting nuclear power. So this conference that just happened in the United Arab Emirates, where Saudi officials spoke about their developing nuclear power, that is an IAEA event that just took place. He's no longer in charge, so there's a new guy in charge of IAEA.
Brian, Fox News is saying the same thing. BBC is saying the same thing. And there's a very interesting quote in a recent BBC piece. Well, actually, it's not that recent. It's from way back in 2013. It's quoting Amos Yadlin, a former head of Israeli military intelligence. He told a conference in Sweden that if the Iranians developed a nuclear bomb, quote, the Saudis will not wait 1 month. They already paid for the bomb. They will go to Pakistan and bring what they need to bring. Well, the Saudis have a relationship with Pakistan that is so close, they consider themselves to be brothers. And the Pakistanis have actually named the fourth largest city in the country after a Saudi, a former Saudi ruler. So the relationship is there. The rumors have been there for many, many years. It's been reported extensively in the press that there is some kind of nuclear weapons cooperation. Certainly the Saudis can pay for a delivery system. I wonder, is this what we're looking at? Are we looking at another nuclear state in the Middle East?
In November 2013, a variety of sources told BBC Newsnight that Saudi Arabia had invested in Pakistani nuclear weapons projects and believes that it could obtain nuclear bombs at will. They already paid for the bomb. They will go to Pakistan and bring what they need to bring, close quote. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, if they were to do such a thing, I mean, it would be somewhat controversial, and it would also be illegal. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a signatory nation to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're not supposed to develop nuclear weapons. They could withdraw from the treaty like North Korea did. And yes, there is such a history of Abdul Khan in Pakistan with his not only developing nuclear weapons in Pakistan, but then selling his wares on the international black market, very likely with the cooperation of the Pakistani military, if not the civilian government in Pakistan. So there's all that. But the other issue, the flip side of this is, you know, they just held a big international forum in United Arab Emirates, which is also building nuclear power plants, supposedly. Saudi officials were a big part of this conference. That, I guess you could say, is the legal pathway to nuclear weapons, because Saudi Arabia is saying they want to mine their own domestic uranium. And they're saying, just like Iran does, that it's all for electricity production. It's atoms for peace. But the point that Mohammed El-Baradei, the IAEA director, made was that, you know, once you have this technology, uranium enrichment or plutonium reprocessing, you can use those materials to make bombs if you so choose. And, you know, that sort of a legal pathway, Saudi Arabia would still have to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty. It would not go over well in the world, especially with Israel and also with Iran. So this is a very dangerous neighborhood to be building nuclear power plants, period, let alone the nuclear weapons proliferation potential.
Kevin, I don't know if you've ever been to Saudi Arabia. I had the misfortune of having to live there for a little while.
No.
It's pretty much the hottest place on earth. They have something like 330 sunny days a year. It's very windy because most of the desert is not mountainous. It's flat. So
Yeah. If
they wanted to, I mean, solar and wind power would just go gangbusters in a place like Saudi Arabia. And God knows they have more oil than they have water. They're practically swimming in oil.
Mm-hmm.
So do they really need nuclear power for electricity? Really?
That's what makes this so suspicious. I mean, U.S. Senator Ed Markey, the Democrat from Massachusetts, who's a 40-plus year nuclear watchdog, but also a renewable energy proponent big time, he pointed out years ago that Saudi Arabia building atomic reactors makes no sense whatsoever for the purported reasons that Saudi Arabia is not only the Saudi Arabia of oil, it's the Saudi Arabia of solar, Markey pointed out at the time. So it's very suspicious. It's about enriched uranium, even enriched to weapons grade, or it's about plutonium you can extract from the radioactive waste. That is bomb material. So that is the danger, and that is the fatal flaw of the non-proliferation treaty. If you're spreading nuclear power technology around the world, you are spreading nuclear weapons technology around the world, and you can't do both. So that's why we need to abolish nuclear, period, because wherever nuclear power goes, nuclear weapons are a half step behind.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're on the phone talking with Kevin Camps about Saudi Arabia's nuclear program. In Abu Dhabi, in the United Arab Emirates, the Saudi chief official at that conference that Kevin's talking about said this: regarding the production of uranium in the kingdom, this is a program which is our first step towards self-sufficiency in producing nuclear fuel. So that's the storyline. What you're saying, Kevin and John, is with all that sun, 330 days of sun, with all that wind, if you want to be independent from oil, and of course, ultimately oil will vanish,
right,
even if it's a sea of oil,
right,
ultimately it will go, it will be used up. You have other options. Under these circumstances, what's the Trump administration likely to do, do you think, Kevin? I mean, the United States, when the United States had the Shah of Iran as its extension of power, as its proxy, because the CIA and British intelligence put the Shah of Iran on the throne in 1953 with the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Mossadegh, during that next 26 years, the United States encouraged Iran to get nuclear power. I mean, the Shah was building, with U.S. help, lots of nuclear power plants all over Iran. That was a chief U.S. ally. Will the U.S. look favorably upon this development with Saudi Arabia?
Well, the U.S. government, and certainly Trump himself, remember his first foreign trip as president was to Saudi Arabia with several of his cabinet members, and they danced together and held the glowing orb together.
The Saudis loved him. They loved him. He said that they loved him.
And that, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars in arms sales, conventional arms sales from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia. So I don't see Trump having a problem with whatever Saudi Arabia wants to do. And just to deepen that point, Michael Flynn, who's in such hot water right now, was also involved, incredibly enough, in a Saudi Arabian nuclear power promotion package, was international in nature. His role was to provide security for Saudi Arabian nuclear power plants and especially radioactive waste export, get the waste out of there before it falls in the wrong hands or gets attacked or stolen, kind of thing. So there's no surprise that Trump would be supportive of whatever Saudi Arabia wants to do in that regard.
I'm looking at Newsweek. The headline is "Nuclear Saudi Arabia Risks Inflaming Middle East Tensions." And then the article goes on and says what's obvious. Saudi Arabia will begin extracting uranium and build its own nuclear power program for economic self-sufficiency, according to the minister. But as Kevin is making the point, nuclear reactors can be used to enrich uranium to weapons-grade levels. And as a consequence, this will set off a new sort of round of confrontation and tension in the Middle East, because Iran, the formidable sort of second regional power there in the Gulf, and Saudi Arabia is clearly targeting Iran, as is the United States, they've given up nuclear weapons.
Right. The Iranians have been clear, and the United Nations has confirmed that the Iranians do not have a nuclear weapons program, at least not right now. Now, the Iranians, and we really do have to put ourselves in the Iranian shoes. The Iranians believe that Israel is a very serious threat to them, but they also believe that Saudi Arabia is a very serious threat to them. And certainly the relationship between the Saudis and the Iranians has been terrible, at least since the 1979 revolution. So if the Saudis are going to go forward with a program that, while not called a weapons program, will allow them to easily weaponize uranium and plutonium, then really the Iranians have no choice but to protect themselves.
Yeah, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Go ahead, Kevin. We have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, that was another point I wanted to make, was when you mentioned that the U.S. had supplied the Shah of Iran with nuclear technology. I mean, one of those was a research reactor in Tehran, which is still operational. So those folks in Iran, perhaps the Revolutionary Guard and other hardliners who would like to have nuclear weapons big time, are very thankful to have that, you know, reactor technology provided by the United States under Adams for Peace. And then you have the, you know, the Israeli nuclear arsenal, which they will not admit to, but is some hundreds of weapons in size. It's just a very volatile mix. And of course, conventional warfare is horrific enough. Just look at Yemen. But what if you get nuclear weapons in the mix, you know? And this is one hot spot on the planet. Then you've got the Korean Peninsula. And it's just too dangerous. We need to abolish them before they end life on this planet.
That's really what it's coming down to. You know, Brian, the news networks, at least the ones here in the States, report this as kind of a one-day story. There's not going to be any follow-up on this story tomorrow. It appeared in the Washington Post today, in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and tomorrow everybody's going to forget that the Saudis have a so-called nuclear energy program. And then we're all going to be shocked 10 years from now when the Saudi government announces, or when a whistleblower leaks, or when the United Nations declares that the Saudis are a nuclear weapons power.
Yeah, and Kevin Camps, we have 1 minute left. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. We've talked before on this show, but I don't want to stop emphasizing it. People become sort of sanguine or sort of relaxed or apathetic about nuclear weapons, but nuclear weapons are all being modernized all over the world. There's thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of operational nuclear weapons. Once one side starts to threaten the other with nuclear weapons, even by mistake, a nuclear war can start. And it's different than any other previous war. I mean, if we have both sides using nuclear weapons. Anyway, 45 seconds, you get the final word.
Yeah, there was just a New York Times article a few days ago about the Korean situation. And what it was about South Korea openly debating whether or not to develop nuclear weapons, Japan very quietly debating it because they are the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then a whole list of other Asian countries that may decide to nuclear arm up. That included Taiwan and Myanmar, Burma, Vietnam, because, you know, if adversaries in the neighborhood have nuclear weapons, then you're going to be tempted to get them too. So we really have to turn this around. If that genie is not stuffed back in the bottle, it may be the end of our species. We have to figure this out.
And let's never forget the North Koreans actually suspended their nuclear weapons program, and then George W. Bush started calling them part of the Axis of Evil, threatened to invade Iraq, did invade Iraq. And of course, North Korea said, okay, guess what? We're getting nuclear weapons, and the ball gets rolling. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Arlington, Virginia by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy group Beyond Nuclear. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear Loud and Clear every day between 4 and 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM. You can also hear it at sputniknews.com, and you can subscribe at iTunes to the iTunes podcast. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.